This program is made possible in part with the support of the Ukiah Valley Conference Center, Sanford House Bed and Breakfast, Ukiah Natural Foods Co-op, and the Ukiah Valley Medical Center. And, of course, StoryCorps. Welcome to StoryCorps, the Mendocino Stories. If you've been with us for the past 3 weeks, you'll know what I mean when I tell you that tonight we're in for a change of pace. Tonight we'll hear from two originals, the soft-spoken couple from Round Valley, who created Live Power Farm. Stephen and Gloria Decatur have touched the California earth, from Santa Cruz to Round Valley. They know the land, and they certainly know the soil. You may not be ready to believe that the story of a Mendocino County farming couple could rise above the stereotypical California farm. But Stephen and Gloria, in their soft-spoken way, will do just that. Their story rises above the typical by creating an oasis in our farming community. By choice, they created a working farm that doesn't rely on tractors, but instead relies on animals to power their farm. And beyond their approach to crops, they became teachers and icons for a true back-to-the-land experience. Join us tonight for this week's story. The story of Stephen and Gloria Decatur. The story of Live Power Farm.
Self-taught man. He loves his work because he loves the land. He can change the hills, plant the trees, dig the wells, spread the seeds, mow the fields, plow the streets in his hometown.
Stephen, I want to know, how did you decide to be a farmer?
It happened by accident, by fortunate accident, I think, because I went to UC Santa Cruz to attend school in 1967, and it was the year that an English horticulturalist, Shakespearean actor, painter, genius came onto the campus and started building gardens for the University of California, Santa Cruz student body, kind of an estate garden idea. And
what was his name?
Alan Chadwick. And I came into that garden having grown up in rural areas but never having considered agriculture as a vocation. And the garden was a place of complete magic and also totally real. Half the garden was vegetables and the other half was flowers and ornamental plantings. And there's something totally magical about a carrot, but it's something that you can pull up and enjoy the magic in a very real way that supports your life. And when I met Alan, I began to realize that there was a whole world of knowledge and skill involved in agriculture that our culture generally doesn't even give us an access or entry to or experience with. And so I was totally excited about learning the history of the plants and how to take care of them and what could be created with a garden. And so I would immediately leave my classes and go to the garden and spend the rest of the day there. And this was during the time of the Vietnam War, and there was a lot of destruction, human and environmental destruction going on through that war. And I felt like in the garden, I was in a place where what I was doing good and creating beauty and health and healing in the world. And so I've been forever grateful for that opportunity that was created there through Alan.
How did you end up farming in Round Valley in Covelo in California, Mendocino County?
Well, after working in the garden with Alan, eventually I began to work full-time in the garden, and eventually the university hired me as the assistant gardener in that garden, which was about a four-acre intensively planted garden, and it was all organic. And after a period, the garden program at the university was expanded to a larger area on the south of campus and became the agroecology program. But at that point, Alan was looking at working outside the university and starting another garden project. And he was invited by a rancher in Covelo, Richard Wilson, who had property and had been following Alan's work in Santa Cruz, and invited him to come to Covelo, offered him a site to work on, and began to seek some funding for the project to get established. And I received a letter in the end of April one spring, inviting me to come to Round Valley, beautiful snow-capped mountains, wildflowers, a place that was not really, I guess, only 60 miles or so from where I'd gone through high school, but it's in the coastal mountains and a little remote, and I hadn't really heard of it, and I had to look it up on the map, and I thought, well, this looks like a good place to go. So I decided to pull up stakes. I was landscaping, freelance landscaping in the Bay Area at the time, and I moved up to Covelo because I felt so strongly that the project needed to be established and exist in the world as a place for people to come in and reform, re-enliven their connection with the natural world. And that was really part of Alan's mission. At one point I asked him, well, how come we're doing all this work and planting, and this garden was one that was cultivated totally by hand with hand tools, double digging, very intensive planting. And Alan replied in his British way, this is so that man can find his affinity with nature. Mm-hmm. And if there's anything that we need in the world now, I would say it's that we find our affinity with nature. And that can only really be done through a direct living experience of being in a garden and seeing creation expressing its gifts and its beauty. And it's then that we realize that all that we have really is a gift from creation, and that really, as Alan used to point out in Genesis, it says man is in the garden to keep it and to dress it. And I just felt so strongly that this was the path for me, that at 19 I totally engaged, and that's been my career ever since. Every year for the past 40 odd years, I've been planting seeds, growing food, growing flowers, and sharing that with other people, and trying to take care of the garden, which is our home.
So you came to Round Valley around 1973, and then I came about 4 years later, and we ended up getting together. Alan Chadwick left the Valley, went on to create another garden somewhere else, and then we started to create our own garden and farm.
We should say that these gardens were always the garden in Santa Cruz and also in Covelo. The gardens were operated primarily by volunteers, by people that came in and apprenticed with Alan in order to learn the skills of gardening and farming. And you came actually in the last
as an apprentice
group,
the last group
as an apprentice that last year that Alan was in Covelo.
So then we got going, and you had a dream for probably many years, and then you started to realize it about farming with draft power. And so how did you start doing that, and what was your dream about that?
Well, I totally appreciated the intimacy and the, you know, sort of exactness that you have in handwork in a garden. You can really, you're intimately tied with the soil and different stratas and the condition of the soil when you're working it by hand. You're feeling it directly through those tools. And that's really a special way to work with the soil, and very rewarding. But on the other hand, I felt like there were more extensive crops other than vegetable crops. There were grain crops, for instance, that I was interested in, and then in the element of livestock raising, there would be pasture and hay and all other crops. And so I wanted to find a way to work with the soil on a more extensive scale, but a way that still was in very close contact and allowed me to maintain that intimacy with the soil. And I thought about draft animals. And I went looking around the county trying to see what I could find. And actually, there was no one around that was working with draft animals at that point. And also, I was just beginning on the farm and didn't have a lot of funds. And I finally discovered a man that had three donkeys who he wanted to find a home for. And so I ended up with the three donkeys, and they didn't know what the job was, and I was teaching myself. So we taught each other. And
you had to create your own harness out of belts and things like that?
Yeah, we had to get some old harness out of the antique store and cut it down to fit the donkeys. And fortunately, at that time, the Small Farm Journal, which is a publication quarterly about horse farming and draft farming and small-scale farming in the United States, was started. And they had some really great articles and initial information, diagrams on harness and pointers about working with the animals. So I just got started with the donkeys, and actually they were quite useful in the farm. They could carry wagons with pretty good loads, and they could do row cultivation with real light cultivators. Plowing was a little slower. A donkey only weighs 400 pounds, so two of them would give you about 800 pounds.
But still, they're pretty strong for their size.
They're incredibly tough, durable creatures, and some people say they're stubborn, but I think that that's a little bit of a misconception. They're smart and they're careful, and they won't do things that, if the driver doesn't know what they're doing, and they shouldn't be doing it, they'll refuse to do it.
It used to be that your only transportation was either your bicycle or the donkeys, and you had a cart for the donkeys to haul feed and things like that from town. And didn't you kind of get stuck in town one time?
I did get stuck one time when we came to a manhole cover that was had water being pumped out of it, and it was running across the pavement. And the donkey, Jack, he saw that water and heard the pump, and his ears went straight up and his feet went straight down. And he was no way going to walk over. I mean, it was only half an inch deep, but it, you know, didn't look right. It was water and slick on pavement, and they're very careful about their footing. So I tried turning him backwards and seeing if I could back him across it so that he wasn't looking at it. And that was a total failure. He knew it was there, and he wasn't going to go backwards either. So then I tried going around the block and putting crossing the water between him and the route home, and that didn't work either. So finally I had to take a completely different course and get where I wanted to go that way on an alternate route.
But, so eventually you made it home.
Yes. But it did give me a sense for, you know, this sort of intelligence of of the animal. And I think another reason that I wanted to work with draft animals is because caring for the earth is not only the soil, but also the air. And when we don't realize today how embedded we've become in the fossil fuel age, which is actually really a short period of time. Before 1900, most food was produced with muscle power. And there were millions of workhorses all over the country, and there were, you know, hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people farming on the soil, working with that. And it was capable of producing the food that was needed.
And the equipment, I think, had gotten pretty sophisticated for farming with draft power. The tools and plows and the corn binder, the grain binder, and all of those things.
That's true, yes. A lot of the equipment had been evolved up to the, say, 1920s to be pretty well-designed and pretty effective for work animals. And there were places where people were using multiple hitches with draft horses of, you know, 12 in a hitch and pulling fairly large scale equipment. And I had one brochure pamphlet from the USDA where they actually were comparing how many acres a day could be done with a multiple hitch team compared with the tractors of 1920, which were much smaller and had a limited range. So that was pretty interesting to see what could be accomplished with horses in that kind of organization.
And when you switched from donkeys to draft horses, what was that like?
Well, I went up to Oregon to an older man that was breeding draft horses and was selling his horses, and was part of a group that friends that were wanted to buy horses and work their farm with draft animals. But they hadn't any experience and they didn't have a equipment, whereas I had the equipment and a certain level of experience from my work with the donkeys. But I went there to Herman Daniels, and we got the horses out for a day before we trailered them down to California. And when I went to harness, it was exactly the same as harnessing the donkeys, except that when I got behind the team of horses to drive them, a donkey is about 4 feet tall at the shoulder, and a draft horse, sometimes you can't see over their backs. And so all of a sudden I was behind two very large muscular rear ends and looking around to make sure that I was, you know, headed right and not going to bump into anything. But other than that, I could drive them perfectly well, and it was tremendous because when we did get them down to California, and a friend from Lake County came over, an older horseman who had grown up with horses, I basically was having to teach myself through this period. And Wesley White came with his grandfather's plow, which looked like it had just come off the shelf. It was perfectly beautiful, perfectly maintained, no rust, no scratches. And we hooked it behind the team of draft horses, and we started at one end of the furrow, and we plowed a 14-inch furrow for 400 or 500 feet and turned around and put the plow back in and plowed another furrow back. When I got to the end of that furrow, I threw my hands in the air and went, hurrah, you know, because it was such a tremendous step forward. With the donkeys, I probably would have had to stop two or three times to get to the end of the furrow. And I realized what the capacity would be with the workhorses, that it would enable us to do so much more. So we've continued to work with them now for
30 years.
Practically 30 years. Yeah. And we're on about, I think, the third generation of workhorses in our farm.
Have and about six of them now.
We have six, and our children have actually grown learned. Up with them and learned to drive them also. So it's really a special skill to have, and it's very graceful to see them working in the field. And, you know, they're pretty reliable. They can, they're generally able to start without a battery charge, and they're self-repairing largely if they're well cared for.
And they're kind of quiet.
And they're very, very quiet. And when you're plowing, you can hear the swish of the soil as it moves up over the moldboard and turns and rolls. And it's a little bit like being in the ocean and hearing that wave of soil roll and seeing the earth open up and knowing that, you know, you're moving into a new planting and a new growth cycle.
And I always enjoy looking out and seeing you and seeing the horses. It's such a beautiful view and so different than looking out at tractors cruising along.
And, you know, it's a personal relationship. You have a personal relationship with each of those horses, and they have their own personality, and you have to coordinate and work with them, and they have to understand in what you're asking, and there's a definite relationship of, you know, mutual respect and awareness, and that's completely different than working with machinery.
And they're very sensitive, and they're very intelligent, and
right.
You have to pay attention to that, and because they're giving you clues all the time.
Right.
And if you don't pay attention to those clues, then, you know, complications could arise.
That's true. There's no off key exactly like there would be with a tractor. So it's all in anticipating what's coming and also seeing it from the horse's point of view so that you can perceive what their reactions are. May be, and you can be prepared for that.
And, you know, our choice to farm with horses kind of added to our other choice of farming biodynamically. It's a wonderful addition to our, you know, desire to be a biodynamic farm. And how did we go about, you know, starting biodynamics, and why were we interested in biodynamics?
Well, working with Alan in Santa Cruz, I realized through his awareness that all of the beings of the earth, multitude of beings, plants, animals, but even there are spiritual beings that stand behind the physical manifestation of each plant and of animals. And they are active in the living world. And Alan did introduce us a little bit to some of the writings about biodynamic agriculture, which was initiated by Rudolf Steiner in Europe in 1923. Through a series of lectures that he gave to working agriculturalists, large-scale farmers at that point in time in Austria. And Steiner in the biodynamic agriculture lectures pointed out that the world of the plant is not just a terrestrial world. It's also the whole cosmic environment. Mm. And the moon is a very obvious. Forces of the moon affect the water and the earth, the tides towards full moon. And that that affects the water in plant growth. And it's not only the moon. Of course, the sun is totally an obvious cosmic force. Without that, nothing would happen, right? And the planets, the moon in front of star constellations reflects certain forces that those constellations are, from time immemorial, have been recognized as being connected with. So you have Earth constellations such as Taurus, you have water constellations such as Pisces, and people have done research, Maria Thun in Germany in particular, about sowing and cultivating the soil, opening the soil to those forces in relationship to the particular sign of the constellation that the moon is standing in front of, in relation to the part of the plant that you want. So if it's a root crop that you're growing, then you might want to do the sowing and the cultivation and harvesting when the moon is in front of a root constellation, which would be an Earth constellation, for instance. So there's a tremendous opening there for the humans to become more conscious of the cosmic influences and to try to actually coordinate the agricultural practices with those cosmic influences. And also in the agriculture lectures, Rudolf Steiner pointed out that the farm is an organism within its boundaries, and it needs to create the things that it needs out of its own organism, and it needs to have all of the different organs and elements present in the farm. So biodynamic farms typically will have, well, of course, the soil and the mineral world is a starting point, but plant crops, but also animals for the influence that they bring. And then the human being is... it's not a farm without a human being. And the sort of consciousness and organizing capacity that the human brings into the natural world can be a magnification of nature. And that, through my work with Alan in Santa Cruz, was a strong awareness that was developed, that man can help magnify what happens in nature, but only by staying within natural laws. And so through biodynamics, we could begin to understand those laws in a much more deep and more holistic way. So we try to create all the inputs for the farming out of the farm organism. So the manure from the livestock is collected, used with the plant material, creates the compost, and then that compost is especially suited for taking care of that particular soil. And then also special preparations that Rudolf Steiner suggested that people could make using plant material and animal material, and fermenting them in a particular period of the year when the growth forces would be the strongest for doing that fermentation and creating, in effect, a new material in the world, material that's made out of naturally occurring materials, plant and animal. The plants in the compost preparations are chamomile, oak bark, stinging nettle, valerian, yarrow,
dandelion.
And dandelion. And we recognize those as having medicinal properties in human health, but they also have very strong properties in the health of the soil and the balancing of calcium and potassium and nitrogen and all the elements in the soil, and developing them in a way that makes them more enlivened and more living in their processes, in their living breakdown in the soil and their transformation into fertilization for the earth. And so...
And the use of these preparations by the farmer, that's a really conscious commitment.
That's a conscious commitment because that material is something that can only be made by humans. It's natural material that you're starting with, but it is only put together consciously and applied, given back to the earth as a healing gift, only through the office of the human being's consciousness and will and activity.
I've seen him do things I just can't believe. Makes gentle giants of those big machines. He moves a boulder like a paper bag. And he moves a tree like it was all he had.
We're just going to take a short break, and if you're interested in getting more information about Stephen and Gloria's farm, or about Rudolf Steiner, Alan Chadwick, or any of the organizations or people that are mentioned in tonight's program, be ready towards the end of the program with a pencil and paper, and we'll give that information to you. I hope you're enjoying this program from StoryCorps in Mendocino County. Now let's get back to Stephen and Gloria.
And blessed is the soul who is truly found something to rest on while the world turns round. I think he'd say this is how he feels.
It's been pretty special, you know, to, you know, develop a biodynamic farm and the, you know, the produce that we grow, and the quality of that produce is, you know, you can really tell a difference between biodynamic and other produce. And so then how did we manage to create opportunities for people outside of the farm to have a connection with the earth and the art and craft of farming? I mean, that's what Alan Chadwick did. And so how were we able to do that?
Well, we've always kept the farm open to other people, often young people, that want to come into a farming environment and live in that life and experience what is needed and what they can give, and, you know, maintain a farm organism. And so we have worked over the years with generally 5, 6, 7 people each season in the farm, gaining direct practical knowledge and experience with maintaining the farm and the different plants and animals. And we also opened the farm to visits from school classes. And
we've been doing that for 27 years now.
Yes.
Maybe 10 classes a year. Mm-hmm. And they come and they stay with us. And they get to do, gosh, they get to plow, they get to shear sheep, they get to milk the cow, they get to feed the animals, they make compost, they dig up potatoes, and, you know, they get a sense of the farm.
They're on the farm for 2 full days and a day coming and going, and so they have a chance to start to feel the rhythm of the life of the farm and to start to work with that, and also to see what's been done over thousands, 12,000 is it, or more years that people have been engaged in agriculture. And during all of that time, there have been people saving seeds and culturing seeds. And the radish that we have today is the product of 12,000 years of human interaction with the original wild. Everything that we have came from the wild. But what we have as cultured plants today is the result of the people keeping that seed in that culture over this tremendous period of time. And for the visitors in school classes that come to the farm, to get an idea of making compost and returning everything in the farm being a gift that serves some other being in the farm. The soil serves the plants create the food for the animals give back manure and food and work, and everything is giving to another part of the life of the farm. And for the children to actually see that happening and then to realize that as humans, we can collect those materials and magnify. I mean, nature makes compost, but not in, you know, a foot and a half a day time frame. And as human beings, we can take our consciousness and our energy and magnify that natural process to give back to the earth. And so I think that then the children start to learn what a special gift life is. And I don't think you can learn that through, movies or video or some kind of once-removed experience. It has to be a direct experience that then changes something in your soul.
I think it's changed a lot of things in a lot of souls, mm-hmm. You know. There's been a lot of people who've come through the farm and, you know, we've run into some of those children who are now adults and they come back and say that was one of the most powerful experiences of their lives. And, you know, they were so grateful, and they remember so many things. And the other way that we are able to share our farm is through our members who get our produce. And what is that? What did we create in terms of how our produce is distributed?
Well, we began farming in the early years more or less as a subsistence farm, operating the farm as a subsistence farm and just using a small portion of the property, which we came on as caretakers. We did not own land to begin with. And we used a small portion of it, and we did a farmer's market in our local town for 5 or 6 years. We were the main producer in the market. But in 1987, we heard about a new concept through some of the biodynamic circles of actually creating a partnership between the people using food, needing food, and the people growing food, and working on a specific farm to meet the needs of the farming, to take care of the soil in a completely healthy way, to meet the needs of the producer so that they could do that work in the world and have a stable and a life that they could consider leading for years and years and even passing on to other generations. And so we formed a community-based rather than a market-based farm. And we started with 15 families, actually families from the Bay Area, where a number of people knew us from their
children
coming to the farm. And we proposed this idea that we would plan and grow a vegetable supply for them each week as diverse as possible within our climate. And that they would, and we gave them a budget of the costs that we imagined are projected would occur in growing this food and taking care of the farm. And then we asked them to split that cost so that the farm would have an economic base that was stable and viable to work from. And then we would take the whole harvest and divide it amongst those supporting members. And that's the way we started, with 15 households in 1988 in San Francisco. And then it doubled each year. More people wanted to work in this relationship, direct relationship with the farm. We have visitor days for them to come and be on the farm and have some time and see how it works. We have core group meetings with those members that want to be involved in some of the decision process for distribution and economics and social activity in the farm.
And we've created a viable way of farming, so that's, you know, the all those members now is up to 200 families between San Francisco Bay Area and Mendocino County, and they, you know, provide the support for the farm from year to year, even if there are some years when there, you know, the weather has been such that, you know, we haven't been able to have the product all 30 weeks that we project. So they're supporting the farm.
They're sharing.
It's not just about vegetables.
They're sharing some of the risk with the farmer, which does not happen in the market system. You know, in the 23 years now that we've been working that way, the farm as a 100% community-based farm and not as a market farm, you know, there's always been enough food. There may be, have been a few years when there were less tomatoes and more, okay, more spinach. But overall, people are still fed. And even in some of these late spring rain years that we've had in the last few years, which I imagine is related to change in climate. The weather patterns seem to be shifting. Even then, we've been able to come up with food for the most part. But in a year when there's been less at the beginning, our members are willing to help us through that period. By continuing support of the farm, realizing that we have expenses in just operating the farm and that have to be continued. And so this is creating an example of a different economic paradigm in the world, which is an association of the eater, the user of the product, and the producer of the product. And the bottom line is not based as in the market paradigm, not based on the private gain, more or less, from individuals, but it's based on the good of the whole community, and that includes the good of the earth and the good of the farmer and the good of the people using the food. And that's really becomes the bottom line of the economic picture of the farm. And the budget can be shared with the members so that they actually understand what costs are involved in farming. Most people do not have an idea today what those costs are. So the budget can become a real educational tool for people that are recognizing that none of us stand alone. In economy, that's what the situation is. We're using products that are from all over, that are produced by all different people. So there's a social relationship that is engendered out of that. It's not a relationship that on one side somebody can get a good deal or the cheapest product, and then on the other side of the equation is the producer not getting what they need in order to have a viable production. And then the economy through the market system is being used kind of to control the other half, the alienated half of your partnership, as it were. Whereas in an associative economy, in this other paradigm of a community farm, people are giving money to their partners in taking care of the earth and producing the product, they are using that money as a way to support each other in supporting each other's lives so that they can carry on the work that they need to do in the world. And I don't believe, actually, that we will have a truly sustainable agriculture until we first develop a sustainable economic paradigm, which I believe this associative economic paradigm can meet that need. So we've consciously maintained our farm as 100% community-based. And because we produce from a live power base of the solar energy of the grass that the sun raises, that the horses eat, that translates to the energy that we work the soil with, and an 18-kilowatt photovoltaic electric system that we're using for pumping all the irrigation water, because we produce from that live power base, we don't have such a huge, extensive amount of product that it can't be utilized by 200 households. But we also don't have a lot of the expenses that you would have in, you know, larger scale fossil energy agriculture. Fuel and machinery costs, for instance.
Yeah, because we're growing our own fuel with the hay.
We're growing our own fuel, and it's sun power. So,
and the thing, you know, I really like, because I used to do the farmer's market thing, I really like about the, you know, being a community-based farm is it's, the vegetables don't have a price. You know, it's not a lettuce is a dollar, or corn is $2. It's just, we're giving the vegetables away because people are supporting us. And it's a very special feeling, and it's a very special way to relate to the earth and the plants and the community that surrounds us.
They're using their economic power to enable us to produce the food, and we're using our economic power to enable them to do the work in the world that they do. And so it's a mutually supportive economic process rather than an economic process that seeks to gain more traction for one individual or the other. The community is good is our bottom line. And as we were caretakers on this farm for 20 years, but realized we wanted to extend into the future permanently, our members actually helped us acquire the property eventually and put it in a form of a permanent farm that has a conservation easement that requires only organic or biodynamic agricultural production, requires that the owners of the farm gain 50% of their income from farming the land, so using it actively, not just having a couple of riding horses and considering it a farm, but using it actively on behalf of the community as a food-producing resource, and that if it is sold to another owner in the future, that it's valued on the basis of its agricultural income stream, what's capable of coming off that 40 acres of land. With that income stream, you could afford to capitalize the land at a certain amount per acre. And that would be the maximum amount per acre that we could sell our agricultural use rights to an incoming farmer for. So that means that this farm is a permanent farm. Protecting the environment, it can't be any kind of polluting agriculture practice there, and it's permanently affordable into the future to another farmer. They could actually pay for it out of their agricultural income, and we're only able to do that because we were a community-based farm. Our members helped us figure out how to legally structure the holding of the land so that it would be held this way. And they also helped fundraise the money required for the purchase of the easement by the 501c nonprofit that purchased and owns and holds all the non-agricultural speculative basically rights and uses of the farm, so that they're not, they're held permanently on behalf of the public.
Never felt magic crazy this. I never saw moons, knew the meaning of the sea. I never held emotion in the palm of my hand. I felt sweet breezes in the top of a tree. But now you're here, bright in my northern sky. A long time that I'm waiting. I've been a long time that I'm blown. I've been a long time that I've wondered.
Live Power Farm was born with Stephen and Gloria's efforts. From Covelo and Round Valley, they created more than a farm. Using draft horses instead of tractors, and ingenuity, plus a passion for what they do, Live Power is more than a farm. It's an educational center, a community-centered food provider. It has a low carbon footprint and a plan to sustain the farm after the Decaturs can no longer dedicate their lives to operating Live Power Farm. You know, who'd have thought that a chance meeting with Alan Chadwick helped Stephen think about gardening and farming? Who'd have thought that their efforts would evolve into an educational outlet for children? Who'd have thought that creating a community of like-minded people, who in turn reap the benefits of delicious food, could in turn become a path to sustaining this farm far into the future? Well, the truth is, Stephen and Gloria thought so. They may not have known in advance just how the farm would evolve, but in the words of another creative person, they chose to think differently. I really hope you enjoyed them tonight, and Stephen and Gloria are an example of how soft-spoken, thoughtful people can make you sit closer to the radio, hear every word they have to say, and hopefully, maybe walk out with a smile on your face. Our thanks to Stephen and Gloria and Live Power Farm. I'll be back in a moment to give you some information on some of the people that they talked about tonight. Stay with us.
Bright in my northern sky.
As promised, here's some additional information that'll answer some questions for you, should you be that interested after listening to tonight's show. You can learn more about Live Power Farm at their website, livepower.org. Information on Alan Chadwick, who died in 1980, can be found at the Online Archive of California at oac.cdlib.org. That's oac.cdlib.org. Additional information about Alan Chadwick is available at learningtogive.org. You can find out more about Rudolf Steiner at biodynamics.com. And information on CSAs can be found, among other places, at localharvest.org. Well, I learned something tonight, and I hope you did too. Next week, we'll be back with more stories from Mendocino County. And until then, this is David Steffen saying thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for supporting KZYX. And I'll see you again on StoryCorps.